understand why we in Tefillah we.
Questions being raised that it would seem from different sources regarding the story of Noah and the flood, that the flood was not simply a form of destroying everything that existed. And then after the flood, the world was reconstituted, and pretty much everything went back to the way it was. That's one way of understanding it. But according to many statements of Chazal, it's more than that. It's different. It means that there was significant climactic changes in the atmosphere, in the conditions that governed human existence. The type of an environment in which man lived after the flood was radically different than the one before the flood. And the essential difference was manifested with regard to the strength of people. That the man, the human being, mankind, by nature, before the flood, was physically much, much more powerful. This is alluded to in the Torah. It talks about the race of giants and different types of things like that, which in conjunction with the statements of the rabbis give us the picture, and this was part of the problem, by the way, that man was so powerful, one of the features being that he lived almost 1,000 years. The Torah records the lifespan. The lifespan of man goes down drastically. It's hard for us to appreciate that, to understand that, or to take it seriously. But that's what the Torah records. And there's nothing that is impossible about that. It's just that as a result of the sin, because man misused the tremendous power that God had given him, that's a different issue. That's part of the study of the story of the flood. And the transformation had a lot to do with the fact that it was a humbling, a weakening of man, because he had utilized this power that he had to magnify his own ego. And this led him to rebel against God. That's a serious issue. That's basically, in a general sense, what's going on in the story of the flood. However, the question is being raised that some people are going further, and they're saying that pre the flood, the weather conditions in which man lived was perfect, so to speak, most suitable for the standpoint of the human being, and they're saying that the weather was about 70 degrees, and they're making the point that it never rained. This leads to a question that people are raising. If so, if there was no rain, so how did crops grow? And we know that they subsisted through crops and farming, and Noah made an invention in terms of the plow to make life easier and so forth. My answer is a general answer, and that is I see no reason to go into the particulars of what the situation was like. You have to know when it's enough to make a general point. That's all that's necessary. And when it's not enough, then you have to go into specifics. As far as I can see, it's important to know in a general way that the physical conditions, the climate that affected human existence was different. Chazal speak in a general way, and they're not necessarily to be taken literally. They speak about man being the strongest of all the animals, which makes sense. And it says that he would lift mighty oak trees. When you utilize certain expressions, it doesn't mean that it has to be taken literally. They're trying to convey a general idea that what was responsible, the major cause that was responsible for the sin, was this tremendous physical superiority that man possessed pre the flood. It's something that we can't imagine because we are all we can understand is how man is after the flood. And obviously everybody tends to view things from the prism of their own experience. That's why people have a difficult time understanding that man could live for 900 years. It's not part of our experience, and it's humbling because we're envious. We always imagine that we're the most advanced in terms of human history. However, once you get that point, there's no benefit now in the particulars. What do I need to know what temperature it was? Does that mean to say that it never rained, that it never snowed, that everything was perfect? All these particulars, what's the point? Before you start to make a conclusion about anything which is specific, you have to explain the justification. My question would not be, how can there not be rain, or how can this, or how, maybe it's better that there should be seasons. How do you know 70 degrees is the perfect? My point, what's the point of getting involved in this? It sounds to me that it's idle speculation. Now, when you're studying Torah, you're not just getting into an area where people can speculate endlessly. People do that. That's a waste of time. In any area, and even in Torah, it doesn't matter. The point is to study the Torah, to try to get the message that's being conveyed to us. Once you get the message that's being conveyed, and there is no further message, and now you're going to go into the types of particulars which are unrelated to any message, it's a waste of time. A, it's a waste of time. B, you really can't know. If the Torah is not a history book. If the Torah wanted to convey to us the types of things that historians would be interested in, it would have done. It doesn't do that. It doesn't give you any kind of knowledge which a historian would be satisfied with. You'd want to know all the particulars. A historian is more interested in the particulars. How did they build their houses, and what did they do in their leisure time, and so on and so forth. The Torah doesn't communicate that at all. It's not interested in that type of phenomena. It's only interested in the moral issues, the development of man from the standpoint of the moral issues of mankind. It does bring in certain very minor details, that there was progress, that there was a plow, etc., because that's necessary. That type of development is essential. But once you get to a certain point, it's not really giving you any information about what the physical or social aspects of life were like. What type of government did they have? How often did they meet? Who made the decisions? You have no sense. You read the Torah, there's no way you can construct a movie or a book which would really convey a sense of what life was like to view, how they moved about, what the cities looked like, what the people did. Nothing at all. So it seems to me that a person is misusing the Torah if they're going to try to gain from the Torah an insight into things which the Torah is not providing you with. It doesn't even tell you what kind of dress, how they dressed, things of that sort. Nothing of any personal curiosity. So then it seems to me that there's no point in discussing these kinds of things. What was the weather like in that time? If that was a matter of importance, first of all, you have to demonstrate what's the importance of knowing. What is important is that there's a significant difference in terms of the atmospheric conditions insofar as it affects the strength, the health, and the longevity of man pre-the flood. And after the flood, he goes to a very, very significant change. And he becomes a being who's much more vulnerable, much weaker, and certainly much less prone to the fantasies of immortality. We're discussing the issue of inhumane treatment of animals. That there are people who don't eat meat, even if it's kosher. And they base it on the idea that it's inhumane to kill an animal. That's contrary to the Torah. And we'll discuss that at a different point. Why, if a person maintains that vegetarianism is a higher level of morality or ethics than eating meat, and that even though the Torah permits it, it's not the highest level, that, in my opinion, is a form of kfir. It's denial of the Torah. It's not true. It's not true that a person that's a vegetarian is on a higher level. And whoever asserts such a thing is denying Torah. If a person says that they are vegetarian for whatever reason, they have a reason, they don't like meat, or it's healthier, perhaps, whatever, that doesn't concern me. I don't mind. It's fine. As long as they're not making any philosophical assertion that this way of living is superior to that which the Torah mandates. We'll discuss that at a different point. But right now, the issue about what you see in our society today is a lot of different forms of so-called idealism. Most of it is phony idealism. People are looking for a cause to cling to. It's easy to be able to distinguish phony idealism. When you have phony idealism, you see that this becomes their all-consuming passion. A person of true justice is going to pursue justice in all areas. It's not just going to seize one cause, and that's going to be the whole essence of their lives. It does not make any sense. It's not to say that certain causes may be of more consequence than others, but generally speaking, you see that these people seize on to one thing, and that becomes the essence. They become obsessed with it. And also, they go to tremendous extremes in carrying that out. That becomes their ultimate ideal. It becomes like a form of idol worship. So you can see that it's not a rational phenomenon. You also see that many of these people pose as idealists, and it's usually in the guise they're pursuing some type of a peaceful ideal. But the truth is that they're very aggressive individuals. And the aggressiveness is hidden to themselves. They won't acknowledge it. Either they're not aware of it, or they can't be aware of it. They want to pose as peace-loving individuals. They have this group called PETA, which is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. The idea of treating animals correctly is part of the Torah. But what exactly constitutes correct treatment of animals is something which human reason in and of itself can't really work out. The Torah tells us what's considered to be appropriate treatment, which is to say that in order to do so, it's only the Creator. One has to know the purpose for which the being was created. The decision as to whether it is permitted to use an animal for work, that the animal should work for man, or not. We should just leave the animal alone. Never mind killing the animal for food. Can a person take an animal and use it, a horse, using a horse as a means of transportation? According to these people, had PETA been around from day one, it's interesting, I don't know if there were any organizations like that in the pre-industrial era. That is, for thousands of years of history, when animals were vital for the existence of any kind of human civilization. I have not read anywhere that there was any organization that was against People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Had they been there from day one, then nobody would have been able to function. There'd have been no development of civilization. Because you couldn't have any civilization without the power that was generated through the use of animals. If you eliminate any utilization of animals and you treat animals as being completely equal, then basically you're not permitted to own an animal, because you can't own another person. And if that were in force from day one, that we would have treated all animals equally, it's just hard to imagine how there could have been a world. For example, they're opposed to any benefit, any utilization of an animal for any purpose. Leather, wool, all these different things. And they didn't have synthetics in those days. It would have been extremely difficult to imagine how you could have survived. What are you going to use for clothing? What are you going to use for food? What are you going to use for transportation? The role that the utilization of animals has played in history. So there never was a phenomenon like that. You also see the real aggression of these people from their tactics. They need an excuse to vent their aggression, so that because there are people that don't agree with them, they will resort to violent tactics. They'll attack people, spray paint them if they're wearing furs, and things of that sort. Now, how can that be possibly justified? It's one thing to say that you have this position, that that's your attitude towards animals. Let's say a person was logically convinced that that's the way it ought to be. the person would also have to recognize all the factors on the other side. Part of being rational is, even if you believe that your position is correct, you differentiate between cases where it's obvious, and anyone that disagrees has to have a real serious problem. You also recognize that that's what you believe, but the other positions are just as legitimate. Clearly, in a case like this, your position is the tough one, is the absurd position. It doesn't make sense. To most people, in any time, in any place, the assertion that animal life should be valued the same as human life is absurd. It's ridiculous. All right, so you have a right to hold such a position. You're living in a free country, and no one's going to prevent you from taking such a position. Now, if you want to educate others, so go ahead and do so. But to act in a manner with such hostility to others that don't agree with the position, when yours is the absurd position, what gives you the right to act out in a violent way against those who disagree? That would only be in situations where it's clear that that your position is correct, and it's absolutely necessary to intervene and even use violence. Clearly, if you see someone that's abusing, attacking a child, or someone's in the process of raping a woman, so you have no choice, you have to intervene. That's clearly wrong, and this person can't defend themselves, and you have an obligation to step in and use violence. That would be a different case. But you can't make that comparison to a situation where, as I said, your position is the absurd position. So what you should do is to try and convince people and win them over. If it were a rational phenomenon of people who've discovered something which no one else sees, then they themselves would understand, and they were peace-loving people. Then they would act in a peaceful manner. Another example of people who are just not in touch with their own nature, who really are very violent but pose as being peaceful, are the pacifists. Pacifists have this sense of idealism that they love peace. So everybody associates something, well, you know, even if I don't agree with you, but I respect you, you know, there's some kind of respect over here because you're so peaceful. You do reflect peace. My opinion, to the contrary, they're very, very hostile. Very hostile, very cruel. There's no compassion whatsoever. I'm talking about a case where a person is pacifistic no matter what. That is to say that in the face of a Hitler, you would be pacifistic. You wouldn't advocate the use of force to stop a Hitler or any other cruel person. So where is your compassion for all the victims? Where's your compassion for them? As a result of your failure to intervene, you are paving the way for this butcher to go ahead and kill all the others, and you feel very good about yourself. You're a righteous person. You're a pacifist. I maintain that that's extremely cruel. And you're aware of this. That is that you may have a repression against one form of aggression. That is, you're not going to embrace violence. You're not going to get involved in that. But on an unconscious level, you're quite okay with all the violence that's being done as a result of your failure to act. Because that's exactly what it is. You become party to that violence. There must be a certain identification with the cruel. And there's got to be a certain place where it doesn't bother you that people are being killed. So that's a very immoral position, and it's a very aggressive position. Essentially, pacifists are killers in a different way. Through the vicarious connection with those who are doing the killing. By refraining from preventing murder, you become a murderer yourself. And that's something, that's a fact which cannot be ignored. And that is a means of gratifying your own, perhaps unconscious, aggressive, sadistic tendencies. One can say, pacifists are sadists. To clarify that statement, because as stated, it's going to sound very harsh. When I say that pacifism is a form of aggression and a form of violence, I mean in a specific kind of a situation. When you confront, when you're in a situation where there is an evil person, a murderer, someone who was going to destroy innocent people. It could be anywhere. It could be someone who's broken into a school and is threatened to kill all the children. Or you have a situation of 9/11 and you have the opportunity. You're in a situation where you could prevent it. But the only way that you could prevent it is by killing the person. By killing the bully. And you fail to do that. What I'm saying is, you do not have a moral right to just stand aside and say, well, I'm not involved in this. I'm neutral. Because what I'm saying is, from an abstract point of view, the failure to prevent something which you could have prevented links you, connects you, and makes you responsible. Why? Because you now become part of the causal chain which is resulting in the destruction of the innocent. If you are in a situation where you could have saved someone and you refrain from doing it, that failure to save is tantamount to murder because you're now responsible for the murder. You had the opportunity to stop it. If you didn't do so you're a murderer. Even though you're not the direct cause of the murder, you're the indirect cause. That's how the Torah views it. Do not stand idly by the blood of your brother. Which means, any situation where someone is in trouble, and you could save them. So now it's you. This person does not have to die. Your intervention would save. Thus, your failure to intervene is the cause of his death, i.e., that would therefore be your murder. Maybe you won't be tried for it, because the law is not going to treat it the same way as if you killed him directly. That is the meaning of pacifism in a situation where the failure to oppose the brutal, the violent, the murderers, is going to be leading to the destruction of the innocent. If you could have stopped it, but then you argue that, well, I'm a pacifist, but you're not confronting the fact that your decision is responsible for the slaughter of innocents. So that's the sadism, that's the aggression. You can't deny that. That's part of the situation. So either way, you're going to be a murderer. A pacifist in that situation that I'm talking about is going to be a murderer. The only question is, who would you choose to murder? The guilty? The aggressor? The criminal? Or will you be responsible for the murder of the innocent victims? Thus, the decision to be a pacifist in that situation not only renders you into a murderer, but much worse, a murderer of those who are innocent and deserve to live, as opposed to a murderer of the guilty, the criminal, the aggressor, who does not deserve to live. That is the truth about pacifism. But people don't want to analyze the premises to the conclusions that they would naturally lead to.